So I think when it comes to winning and losing, coaches face two really big challenges. First, the fear of losing keeps us from focusing on the process, or at least it steals the joy of that process. A losing season or losing a big game weighs in the back of our mind. You know, what would it mean for us, our job, our image? Second, we've all heard and maybe have experienced this, which is where the pain of losing exceeds the joy of winning. I think the problem goes beyond the pain of losing. It's where losing derails us from our strategy. We have a tough loss and we feel we have to scrap everything we planned that season. And probably even more unfortunate is losing derails our leadership. We're calm, we're confident, we're focused on the process, we're emotionally balanced, we're sleeping well, and then we drop some hard games and we start to spiral out of control. How do we stay focused on the process in the midst of losses? How do we not let the fear of failure get in the way of bringing our best self to our jobs and enjoying our journey? That's what we're unpacking in part two of our conversation with Annie Duke today. If you missed last episode with Annie, be sure to check it out. She's a New York Times bestselling author and former World Series of Poker champion. And I know you'll find today's episode really valuable. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast, the podcast to help you grow as a leader and build a better culture. My name is JP Nerman, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Nate Sanderson. In addition to this podcast, I'm a leadership coach and culture consultant. To learn more about how my business, TOC, can support you and your organization, visit tocculture.com. This episode is brought to you by the TOC newsletter. Every Thursday, you'll receive a short email with food for thought from Nate or my Leadership 311, which includes three thoughts, one tip, and one question on a specific leadership or culture topic. If you sign up for the newsletter, you'll also receive the notes to each episode of the podcast, as well as our top 10 podcast episodes and my top 10 articles. Subscribe using the link in the description of this episode or simply go to tocculture.com and click on newsletter. Coach, are you struggling to hold your athletes accountable to cultural standards? Do you have athletes that aren't living up to the standards in practices, games, or in the classroom? You're not the only one. Holding athletes to high standards in a way that strengthens relationships instead of damaging them is a critical and difficult skill to master. But we all know how essential it is. Failing to effectively hold athletes accountable can sabotage your culture and break trust between you and your team. And to be honest, there's just a better way of holding athletes accountable than the old school methods of punishing them with conditioning or yelling at them, which is why I'm excited to share with you one of our latest online courses, Holding Your Athletes Accountable. In this self-paced online course, you'll get a blueprint for how to hold your athletes accountable in a way that enforces your standards and maintains strong relationships at the same time. The course covers three types of consequences you can use to enforce your standards and how to know if it's time to remove a culture killer from your team. The course contains four modules and over 23 lessons that will help you hold your athletes accountable to the standards of your team or program. To get access to the course, go to tocculture.com/store or click the link in the show details. You talk about so much of this just brings to me this fear of failure that oftentimes what that means for a coach, what that means for a team. I'm curious from your perspective, from your experience as a poker player, like I think so often coaches let that fear of failure drive them to making poor decisions, you know, decisions that they know probably intuitively, or even look at the stats and numbers they should make. But I'm just wondering as a poker player, how did you overcome that fear of failure? And on the other side of there is potentially the joy of winning, right? Like we go into the big game, we're more afraid of losing than we are excited about the possibility of winning. Yeah. You know, what was your relationship like that with that as a poker player?
You know, I think poker, let me just say poker is a little bit different because I can't get fired. So it makes
you can go broke though, right?
I can go broke, but that's actually how you get over it. Because the thing about poker is that how you're pushing up or down your win probability actually translates into what your long-term results are, right? So in a way that you realize much more quickly, because I'm like football, what are you playing? 16 games or something, right? Like it's not a ton of games, you know, and obviously like, you know, basketball, baseball, you get a lot more games, but even so, like what happens in a season is not necessarily indicative. It's not 100% skill that's driving those outcomes, right? You find, you either figure it out or go broke is the answer in poker, because it happens pretty quickly because the feed you're cycling through really, really quickly. I had a lot of mentors who really worked with me on this idea of like poker is one long game. And that's the thing that you sort of have to realize, right? Is that what happens in any particular hand or any particular game of poker has some information embedded in it, but you're going to play more. Even the best poker players in the world, you know, at least in a game like limit poker, in an 8-hour session are going to win 56% of the time. So 44% of the time, you're going to walk away from that table a loser. So you just have to learn to become much less focused on the winning or the losing, which is hard. I'm not saying I was perfect at it by any means. It's difficult to do. And much more focused on how could I have maximized the hands that I was playing? Should I have played that hand? Should I have folded it? I've talked probably more about hands that I won, where I think that I played them poorly or did not play them optimally, than hands that I lost. I feel in some ways that I have a clearer head about the hands that I won, because I'm not feeling so defensive about it. I think it's easier to overcome with really getting into sort of a long-term mindset and having a good group around you, where you can really talk through hands in a way where you're not just talking about whether you won or lost, because they don't really care, to tell you the truth. They're really just talking about what was the quality of the play. Sports is different, because the problem is, like, you have to deal with the owner who might not understand this stuff. And, you know, if you lose, you get fired. You have to deal with the fans, you know, going nuts. And it's all fine and good for Bill Belichick to start going for it on fourth down. Like, who's going to fire Bill Belichick, right? But, like, for a new coach or someone who doesn't have the championships under their belt that Bill Belichick has, there's a big motivation to play it safe. Because, again, when you play it safe and things don't go well, people are like, oh, tough luck, right? Like, oh, that was too bad. That was hard. They're not calling you an idiot. So I think that they're sort of systemically, something needs to change. There's a football club called Plymouth Argyle, whose chairman is a guy named Simon Hallett. He sort of handled this problem by essentially giving his coach manager, because in English football, it's managers, his manager something equivalent to tenure. So, and the reason for that is that I didn't know this, but the average tenure for a manager in the championship league, which I think is the league that he's in, or in English football anyway, is a year. Like, you lose, you're out, you win, you're in, you know, and obviously a year isn't enough for you to know very much about the coach. Like, you know, and you saw that, for example, with the 76ers, where Sam Hinkie, you know, had a plan, and obviously he was going to build a team, but he had to tear the team down in order to do it. And there just wasn't enough patience to allow him to actually stay there long enough for what he was intending to do. And he ended up getting fired. So, you know, we see this all the time, like tearing down a team to build a new one is like a very dicey proposition, even though it may very well be the right choice in the long run. So what Simon Hallett has done is just his coach has tenure, you know, and if they lose 5 games in a row, he's not, his head isn't exploding, because he's just looking down, he's looking at the decision process. And notice that what that does is it allows the coach to take more risk, right? Appropriate risk, to do things like, you know, build the team. And particularly in British football, it's important to do that, because a win is 3 points, a draw is 1. So there's a lot of reward for taking those risks that are going to get you a win, and not too much punishment between like a losing, which is 0, you just don't get points for it, you know, and a draw where you only get 1 point. So the payoffs are such that you should be really going for wins there, but people don't want to do that because they're afraid. So, you know, I think that these things have to be structural. I think that GMs really need to understand this problem. And I think that fans, you know, teams should be trying to educate their fans better, which sort of Bill Belichick did, right? Because football fans in the know would be highly critical of someone not going for it on fourth when they know they're supposed to now. But that was a very long time coming. You know, we need to figure out a way, like, how do you educate fans? You know, if you're in college, how do you educate boosters? They matter. You know, how do you educate the administration? You know, and how do we think as either, you know, either as an owner thinking about the GM, or as an owner and a GM thinking about the coach, really focusing in on the decision process and not what the short-term outcomes are. Because if you, otherwise you're not going to get any innovation.
Well, it's that decision process that I want to transition to here, kind of in the last third of our conversation together. And I want to tell you a story just to give us a context to kind of work with here, just from our season last year again. At the end of the story, I want you to kind of talk us through how would we evaluate the quality of the decision that we made. Okay. Right. So during the regular season, we played a team that was ranked, eventually the second ranked team in the state. They're in our conference. We played them. We're down by 10 with 4.5 minutes to go. And as I said before, we're playing all 2-3 zones. So we've worked on this other defense called a chaser defense, where essentially we put one defender on their best player. And it's something that we've had in our back pocket. We haven't done a lot of it. And so after a timeout, down by 10, we go to the chaser. And Solon, the team, doesn't score the rest of the game. And we miss a shot at the buzzer that would have beat them. So we lose the game by one. Fast forward about 3 weeks later, we play them again in the regional final to go to the state tournament. My coaching staff and our players were debating, do we start in the chaser and run their best player around and try to keep her from getting the ball? Or do we start in our base defense that we played the whole year and have that in our back pocket again? So we decide after a long deliberation to start in the chaser. And so we do. They jump on us 13-4. So we get down by 10 and can never really, we changed our defense back to base. We played even the rest of the game and we end up losing by 14 and they go to the state tournament. So my question for you is, now looking back, and I understand it's all probability based, but how do I, or how do we as a coaching staff evaluate the decision process for choosing the defense in the second game?
Let me ask you something. In advance of getting input on that decision, did you think about what are the inputs that I need here? If I'm getting feedback on this, what are the judgments that I need to get from the people that I'm eliciting the feedback from? So let me give you an example. One thing that I might want to ask is, how much do you think it lowers the effectiveness of the chaser that the team has seen it before? So that would be an example of a question that I would want to ask. And you could ask like, how many more points do we think that they will score because they have seen it before? What's the probability that they're coming in with a response to it? So I would want to ask some questions like that. How effective do we think our regular defense will be? So on and so forth. So you would know better than I. These are things that are just coming off the top of my head. I would want to know those things. And then what I would do, and this is going to get to how do we evaluate the decision, is I would then have that set of questions, which have estimates, right? Like I would want to say, like, what is their increase in expected points per possession because they've seen it before? Give me your estimate of that. And then give me your rationale for why you think they're going to score more points. Because you may say zero. I want your rationale for that. You may say, you could say per quarter or whatever. If we run the chaser, you know, they may say, I think they're going to score 10 more points than they did the last time in whatever period of time. Here's why. I want to get some sort of like very pretty precise estimate and then some rationale that goes along with it. And I would have decided that in advance. So this is something that I recommend to people when they're trying to get group feedback, is generally we'll go into a meeting and start discussing. But what I recommend that people do is before you go into the meeting, say, well, what questions am I going to ask them? What's the feedback that I'm going to try to get from these people? And then actually create like a form. I would then send that out to each person individually to fill out. Now, I would then share everybody's opinions with the group, come into the group discussion, and very specifically talk about the areas where people disagreed with each other. Not talk too much about the areas where they agree with each other, because that's good signal, but you don't really need to talk about that too much. Like, everybody agrees. But what I would say is, you know, JP, you think that the fact that they've seen it before is not actually going to improve their output, their productivity. And Nate, you think it's actually going to drastically improve their productivity. In fact, maybe you think that they're going to be even more productive than if we run our regular defense, because they're going to have thought about this. It was unusual. And they're going to, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, JP, you think it's not going to help. Can you give me your rationale as to why that is? You'll say your rationale. I'll say, anybody else who also is sort of in your zone of not thinking it's going to be particularly helpful that they've seen it before, I'll now say, do you have anything to add to what JP said? And then I'm going to move on to Nate. I'm going to say, Nate, you think it's going to be a disaster. Can you tell me why? Now, I'm not going to expect anybody to agree here, but we're now going to surface all the opinions on the team. Ultimately, Nate is head coach. It's going to be your decision about what you run, right? But now you've gotten everybody's input. Now I can go back and evaluate the decision. And I'll tell you why I can go back and evaluate it, because I can go look at it. It's not like, oh, we're trying to recall so-and-so thought this or so-and-so thought this or this. We actually thought about what are the pieces of this puzzle? What are the things that we need to model here? And let me get that from everybody independently, so people aren't cross-influencing and, you know, people may know where I'm leaning, and that's going to change the way that they lean back and so on and so forth, right? I'm going to now know what everybody thought. I'm going to understand what the structure of the decision was. And coming out of that, I'm now going to say, okay, this is what we're going to do. Then once you've decided this is what you're going to do, you then should do an extra step before you go into the game, which is, let's say that your decision is to run the chaser. What you're going to say is, what will I see that will pull me back into the other defense so that you can get there quicker? Because my guess is that you switch to your regular defense too slowly, because that's just human tendency. So I'm not taking a wild guess at that. I'm taking an educated guess at that. Because you're like, no, it's, well, I want to give it a try, you know, so on and so forth. So you can say, well, let me think, if I were a coach, what would my response to the chaser be that I think would be really effective? So now you can set some kill criteria, and you can say, okay, if I see them responding in a particular way, I'm immediately going to go to the other defense. That, and if you have that sort of action plan set out for you, and you can obviously set out an action plan in the reverse direction if you try to go to your regular defense, you can set out the same kind of action plan. But notice that now what I have is, I now have a way to evaluate your decision. It doesn't matter if I have a way to, what matters is you have a way to evaluate the decision where you can go back and look at it. Does that make mm-hmm. sense?
It does. And, you know, one of the things, and applying it straight really from your book too, the questions that I asked myself after that game was there information that we didn't have that we should have had in, you know, that would have informed our decision better. And so when we went back and watched the first game in those last 4.5 minutes, it was almost the same as the end game situation I talked about before. They missed 3 or 4 open shots that they normally would make, and we got hot at the other end. And so now all of a sudden, when we go 9-0, again, the narrative on the outside looks like the defense was the thing. And then I also, after talking to their coach, who I get along with pretty well, he told me after the first game, he didn't even recognize that we were in the chaser. So they're running regular stuff against a defense that's, you know, designed to limit their best player, making no adjustments whatsoever to that defense. And as you alluded to, the second time it's on film, and now they're going to be much more prepared, obviously, than they were the first time. And those were things that we hadn't necessarily considered. And I hadn't looked at the film closely enough to really understand, maybe have a more accurate understanding of what happened the first time that we ran it. Does that make sense?
So here's another reason why this method that I just outlined to you is actually really effective. First of all, if you had had people answering, I assume that you were discussing this in a group setting.
Yeah. I mean, individual conversations with different people, exactly, it wasn't right. necessarily a Yeah, but yes.
So if you would actually sort of set out, here's the opinions that I want from you. Just go fill this out. Don't worry. Don't have a conversation with me. Just fill it out. First of all, you might have been more likely to find those things out, exactly those things that you're talking about. But secondly, and I think that this is also just a really important thing, if I ask you something really specific like this, what do you think the increase in productivity is going to be, or decrease, if we run the chaser? I'm now asking you for something very precise. I'm asking you for, give me an estimate of the points scored. In order to answer that, you're going to be more likely to go seek information, right? So do you feel that, right? If I am asking you to answer these things, do you think the chances that you go back and look at the film are going to increase?
Right. Yeah. And it's a different question than, Annie, what do you think about this idea? You know, exactly. Or is this a good idea? You know, right? Right? Which is
the problem is like you probably said, do you think this is a good idea? And people are generally pretty agreeable. And probably they were like, yeah, it's, you know, whereas if you would ask them independently, where it's like, what do you think the productivity is? What do you think the chances are? Like, how do you think they're going to respond to it? What do you think the adjustment is that they're going to make? Do you think that adjustment is going to be effective? Right. So you think about, what are all the things that I would ask them in a conversation? And then you actually put that down on paper. Well, how am I going to know what adjustment they're going to make? I have to think about what I would do, but maybe I want to go back and look at the last game and see what they did. Right. If I want to understand what their productivity is going to be, I might want to go back and look at the last game and see how many opportunities they had. Right. Because it's hard for me to estimate those things if I don't go back and look at what happened in the last game. So it spurs you to go look at information more, so you get two things out of this. Thing number one is, it tends to increase the quality of the decision at the time, because it does make it for a sort of more open-minded discussion. You tend to see more dissent than you otherwise would. And dissent is a very good thing. It's why you have more than one person in the decision, because you want to see where people disagree. That's the exciting stuff. That's where all of the like great decision making occurs, is in the dispersion of opinion. So you're getting all that stuff. It gets you to go find out what you don't know. Like, ooh, this is hard to answer. Maybe I should go look at something. So that's really helpful. So just in terms of the decision quality, it increases decision quality. But in terms of the retrospective look, now you're talking too. And now as I go back and try to think about like, well, what was I thinking at the time? What did I miss? It's all there in writing for you. You can say, given what I knew, that was pretty good, actually. Maybe I would change my process going forward. Maybe now I've learned if I change something, I should go look at whatever, right? It really helps you to go back and take a really deep dive into that decision that gets you away from the results. And you should go look at that, whether you won or lost. Because the thing is, like, it could be that you blew them out and you weren't expecting that. And you should go look and say, well, then let me look at what I was thinking, because I thought this was going to be close, but we would just edge them out and we blew them out. What did I miss? Did I miss anything? Or did they have a player injured? Right. So this is the best way to sort of get decision quality. And you're really killing a couple birds with one stone there, because that kind of process helps you both prospectively, but also retrospectively.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we go back to that idea of finding peace as a coach or as a decision maker. When you take that approach, you can look at it in one hand and say, is there something that I should have known? Well, now I have an idea of how to know that in the future, or where to look for that information in the future. Or you may also conclude, there's no way we could have known that, you know, and there's
exactly
even
right.
Then there's peace in that. Right. And so, I love
peace in that. I mean, there's the thing is, you know, I think there's so much peace in that. There's such a good example, right? Which is like, look, it's kind of obvious to us when a pandemic hits that we couldn't have known it. So I think that, you know, you have a restaurant, it fails or something during the pandemic, because it requires people to be in your restaurant and nobody's there. I think that we can all kind of get our heads around, you know, I couldn't have known that. There's no way I could have known that. But things aren't normally as in your face as the pandemic. It's just so obvious that to say, I should have known a pandemic was going to hit, is just a level of silliness I don't even understand. You know, is it silly to say, you know, I should have known that Bill Belichick was going to run that play? Well, it is silly, but it doesn't feel as silly because it's not so obvious, right? I mean, it's a football play. Shouldn't you have thought about it in advance? And it's like, well, no, you shouldn't have known that because you didn't see it. I mean, it wasn't on tape. So I think that that's something, it's such a good question to ask yourself. But then we can also say, we can also ask ourselves the reverse question, which is, do we feel like we knew it when actually we didn't? So that's the other thing, because a lot of times what happens on the, you know, is we'll have that moment we'll say, I knew it. I knew we were going to win because blah, 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 blah. And it's like, no, you didn't. Go back and look at what you were thinking. You didn't know it. So it helps you kind of in both directions, right? Where you're beating yourself up feeling like you should have known, and you kind of go back and you sort of realize, actually, I couldn't have known. But it also helps you when you have that, I knew it, because you can go back and look and say, no, you didn't. And we all have those people, right, in the meetings who say, I told you so. And it's like, go back and look, you did not tell me so. That wasn't true. So it you know, that kind of thing, it really helps like in a lot of, I think, in a lot of different directions.
Well, can I ask you one more question to get you out the door here? You know, we've talked through a lot of things already so far, but if you were going to give coaches one piece of advice on just how to improve their decision making, what would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to do with like just really sort of thinking in this very process-driven way about really what the long-term win probability is, right? Like get into a more of a long-term mindset as opposed to a short-term mindset. I think that whether it's in-game, you know, streaks where the other team, you know, goes on a streak or you go on a streak, or, you know, just after a win or a loss, I think that we really do over-rotate on short-term outcomes. And it causes us to sort of like swing our decision-making around, right? Where we have a particularly good game and now we're over-rotating on that, thinking let's do exactly the same thing so that we can repeat it. Or we have a particularly bad game and we're thinking, I got to rip the whole defense out now, right? I've got to change everything. And the thing is, no, you don't. Not usually, because, you know, it's the old thing, like a third of your games are going to be better than usual. A third are going to be about average and a third are going to be below. I mean, that's just kind of the way that statistics works. And what happens in the short run, if the other team goes on a, you know, a 5-point scoring streak or something, or, you know, in your case, right, like the team didn't score, but the more that we can stop thinking about what's happening in the short run and get into a mindset about winning in the long run, the better off we're going to be. And a lot of that means that you have to start to institute this different mindset and this different process where, to be honest, like I think you gave the best piece of advice. Doesn't matter whether you won or lost, you should be obsessively looking at what was the influence of luck. What are the things that we actually did well that are repeatable? In the case of a win, that means you have to say, did you do it well enough? Did you win because you got lucky or because you executed really skillfully? And even if you executed really skillfully, how can you execute even more skillfully? What can you do better? And if you don't have that type of mindset, if you're not approaching wins and losses the way that you describe, Nate, I think that you're going to have trouble winning in the long run. But that's the mindset that you have to have. And like I say, like obsess. You have to be obsessed with that.
You obviously speak so well and about the logical thing, but at the very beginning, you talked about how our brain does shortcuts. You know, it tries these shortcuts and there's these mind traps and there's so much emotional thing and how,
yeah.
I'm just so, curious how a poker player overcomes the emotional parts of it.
So there's a couple of things. So there's something called tilt, which is a word that we use in poker. For people who used to play old timey pinball machines, you will recognize what tilt is. So when you played pinball, if you shook the machine too much, trying to get the ball to do what you wanted it to do, it would short circuit. And your brain does the same thing. So there's an inhibitory relationship between the emotional centers of your brain, particularly the amygdala, which senses danger, and the prefrontal cortex, which is where all of your rational thought is occurring. So those have an inhibitory relationship. So when you're emotional, your brain really does actually go on tilt. In other words, like it shuts down like a pinball machine. So there's a couple of different things. One is that you can really train yourself to sort of, think about the long-term outcomes. In poker, obviously, in some situations, not all, I can get up from the table if I feel that happening to me. I can't do that in a tournament, but I could do that in cash games. In some cases, get out of the situation is the answer. But obviously that's not practical in most situations. So you have to kind of get yourself calmed down. So there's a few different strategies that you can do that to do that. One is to think, is this really going to matter in, and think about some point in time. You know, if you're really upset about one loss, or for example, you can say at the end of the season, is this one loss going to have determined whether we win or lose? Now, obviously, if it's the very last game and it's a must win, it will. But mostly your answer is going to be no, this one loss is not going to determine whether we win our division, or it's not going to make a lot of difference. So if you can sort of project yourself out in time, even if a team goes on a streak, you can say, like, is this going to matter at the end of the game that much? Because a lot of times the answer is going to be no. But just the exercise of trying to project yourself into the future does something very interesting, which is that as humans, we cannot imagine the future without using the front part of our brain. So the reason why a cat or a dog doesn't think very much into the future is because their prefrontal cortex is just much smaller than ours. So we have this very big front part of our brain that allows us to imagine even past our own lifetimes. So once you start that exercise of, well, imagine it's next week. Looking back on this, how am I going to feel about it then? Just the act of engaging in that is going to calm your brain down for you. So again, because it's an inhibitory relationship, it works both ways. If you get really emotional, that will shut the front part of your brain down. But if you can get your front part of your brain going, that will shut the emotional part of your brain down. So that's number one. Number two is you can actually start to do the exercise that Nate talks about. Well, let me think about this. Like, what was the influence of luck? Could I have known this was going to happen? You know, was there a better decision that I could have made? When you start to do those types of analyses, again, you're moving into the front part of your brain. And so it's going to shut the emotions down. So this is a very common poker thing that I would do, where I would start to actually try to memorize the hand for myself and start to go through the actions that I had taken. First, just to think about, could I have improved on those? Do I feel like I took the right line of play? But also because I want to relay it to somebody else in the future. And I don't want to have to tell them that I went on tilt afterwards, right? So notice I'm thinking about the future because I'm imagining having to talk to somebody else. I'm trying to memorize the hand now because I want to be able to discuss it with somebody later. And that's actually calming my emotions down, because the big problem with getting emotional is that the next decision you make is going to be really crappy if you're emotional, right? So we're trying to protect ourselves against the next decision that we make. So that is also doing that. And the third thing, which is why I'm imagining talking to somebody else, is to make sure that you have someone you're accountable to. The more that you can be pairing off, at least, or maybe have a group of three people where you can really sit down and share, here are the decisions that I was making. Here's what I was thinking at the time. Can we walk through this? What would you have done in this situation? You know, what would your response have been? And you're doing that sort of these post-game analysis, which I was doing a lot of in poker. What happens is that not only do you get something out of the post-game analysis where they're helping you to think through, were you in the right defense, right? But did you notice that those people were open and they just missed or, you know, or whatever? Actually, even though you lost the game, I think that you made really good decisions. Whatever the discussion is that you're having, that's helpful to you for learning, but it's also helpful to you when you're emotional, because you're now imagining, I'm about to go on tilt here and I'm going to have to go talk to the person that's in my group and tell them about how I started splashing around in the game because I was just mad that I lost. So having that, you know, somebody that you're sort of accountable for, that sort of acting as like a somebody who's a truth seeker or a decision coach for you, and you're doing the same for them, helps to actually keep you calm in the moment, because you know that you're going to have to go explain yourself later. And that will help to keep you calm. And then it becomes a habit of mind, because at some point you run these reps enough that you just sort of say, that hand doesn't really matter.
New thought habits are trained.
The bluff didn't work. Oh, well.
Yeah. That's awesome.
I want to add one more thing, and I know we got to go here, but you were talking about having that council of elders, so to speak, and I'm really fortunate that the aunt of one of our players is a former Division I coach that's now retired. So she comes to all of our games, watches all of our film and stuff. And so I'll always do a post game with her, but the conversations are really about what would you have been thinking when we called this timeout or they did this. You know, it's really just, call it checking work, but it's exactly, you know, what you described there of having somebody else that was observing the same situation. And then what I miss, you know, what would you have been thinking? Yeah. What options then, we, you know, that.
Nate, so let me ask you, when things are going really mad and you're super pissed because the ref made a terrible call or whatever, the kinds of things that can cause us to sort of lose our mind and do stupid things like get ejected from the game or whatever, when that happens, does the fact that you know that she's there and you're going to have to talk to her later, does that sort of get you in? Do you feel like that gets you sort of calmed down or sort of stopping yourself from like hurting yourself going forward because you're upset about something that just happened? Do you feel like it gets you into a better place because you know you're going to have this, you're going to be having this discussion later with her?
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest effect for me is because she's really good at this of just saying, yeah, I've been there. I know exactly how that felt, you know, when the official did this and that point in the game. And I thought you handled it this way, or, you know, when I blah, 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 you know, so yes, in a lot of ways, it's comforting to know that somebody not only, you know, is seeing the game in terms of decisions, but has felt those moments before. And that in a lot of ways normalizes those emotions so that, you know, we can get into all the science there. But I think when they're just acknowledged, they tend to start to, you know, re-regulate or whatever. And so, yes, knowing that somebody's been there and they can identify with that is very helpful.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's exactly right. And then it starts to become a habit of mind. So like if she were to go away now, you would have now developed that way of thinking about things. And that just sort of brings up one of the biggest decision-making strategies is get outside help. And you know that, right? Like the way that you see other people's decision-making is so much more clear than the way you see your own. So if you can get outside help, it's always going to help your decision because other people are looking in on your situation are generally going to be seeing that situation more clearly than you yourself see it. And that's just sort of the nature of the beast. And so, you know, I have all sorts of people that help me with my decision.
Well, that's awesome. I appreciate you sharing that. And for our listeners that want to check out your work, is there anywhere you would direct them to find your books and websites and things like that?
First and foremost, please check out the Alliance for Decision Education, which is a nonprofit that I co-founded. And we're trying to bring decision education through K through 12 students, really across the country and the world. We want everybody to get it. There's two things that determine how your life goes. One is luck and the other is the quality of your decisions. And we should be teaching more decision-making and less trigonometry in terms of really generating great outcomes for kids. So please go check out the Alliance for Decision Education. We also have a cool podcast there where we have all sorts of amazing people who are decision scientists on there, including, for example, Daniel Kahneman, who's a Nobel laureate. I have a Substack called Thinking and Bets. I write something generally at least once a week. So if people want to know what my running thoughts are on decision-making, you can catch that there. Some of those are free-form writings. I do a lot of interviews with authors who are publishing books in the space. And so people seem to enjoy that. You can obviously find all of my books at your local bookseller or on the e-retailers like Amazon. And I have a website you can check out, annieduke.com, and you can contact me there.
Okay, that's it for our conversation with Annie Duke. Definitely check out Annie Duke's work. Also, in next week's episode, Nate and I are going to be unpacking another of the Mind Trap series, the Mind Trap on Agreement. It's very similar to the Mind Trap on Rightness. And I think you'll get a lot of value out of both those episodes, 320 and 323, really all interconnected with what Annie Duke has been talking with us about the last two episodes. I want to thank you for listening in to today's episode of the Coaching Culture Podcast. If you find it valuable, we'd ask you to take 30 seconds to just subscribe to the podcast, leave us a review, and then share this episode with a few of your friends. Your support goes a long way into growing transformational leaders in the world. Coach, are you frustrated with where your culture is at? Are you struggling to bring the vision you have for your culture to reality? Or maybe you're feeling on the brink of burnout in your coaching. Or maybe you just feel like you're not the coach you want to be yet. The truth is that many teams fail because the leaders lack clarity on their leadership philosophy. Coaching is way too hard of a profession to thrive in if you don't have a clearly defined leadership philosophy, which is why I'm excited to share with you one of our latest online courses, Clarifying Your Leadership Philosophy. In this self-paced online course, you'll get a roadmap for how to develop your own leadership philosophy so that you can become the leader needed to build the culture you want. The course covers topics like crafting your own mission and vision statements, clarifying your core values, establishing personal disciplines, creating your own leadership manifesto, and much more. The course contains 4 modules and over 25 lessons that will help you clarify your leadership philosophy and become the leader needed to build an extraordinary team culture. To get access to the course, go to tocculture.com/store or click the link in the show details.